Before I tell you the topic of today's talk, I'd like to quote an ancient Buddhist commentary that gave a one-word explanation for the defining characteristic of the Dharma. And the reason to begin the talk this way is the hope that this quality of the Dharma, essential quality of the Dharma, you'll keep in mind as you listen to this talk. An ancient text called the Milindapana said that the defining characteristic of the Dharma is harmlessness. Some of you know the Indian word ahimsa, still used to this day. Nowadays, usually translated as non-violence. But the context of the time, I think, harmlessness. So the endeavor of Dharma practice is, in fact, an endeavor to find a life that causes no harm. No harm to others, and no harm to ourselves. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a profound thing to have that as a dedication. And perhaps we can also, in the background of this talk, keep in mind some of the great figures of the last century who changed our world by their tremendous efforts to be harmless. So Mahatma Gandhi, so simple, at least he appeared simple, sitting there with a spinning wheel. And Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, she didn't do a lot, but she did something. She just didn't get up. And then Nelson Mandela, who we are being buried as we speak. What an effort, 27 years in prison. And something kept him going, tremendous, you know, he was already kind of an old guy. And he kept this persistence, dedication, he was really intent. And he lived such a life of harmlessness at that point in his life that he garnered the respect of his jailers. And they, of him, he had some respect for some of them, so much so that when he was inaugurated, he invited some of his jailers to come to his inauguration as his guest. Isn't that nice? So what kind of effort does it take? 27 years in jail. What kind of persistence, what kind of intent, what kind of long patient, long view to be in it for the long term and for what it takes. So the topic for today is right effort. And it's not the traditional sequence to go from right intention yesterday's talk to right effort today. But the full Eightfold Path is meant for our full lives. And so the middle sections certainly apply to retreat life, but are more relevant outside. So we'll save that for the last night when we're getting ready to return to our regular lives. So the Eightfold Path begins with right view. And that's the view, the understanding, the perspective that helps us find the path. And it's a wonderful view because it keeps things pretty simple. I kind of think of it as a simplest kind of description of a path to liberation that there could be, free of supernatural ideas, creeds, metaphysics. It's kind of the most basic. It shows us the path. And then in order to walk the path, it really helps to have the right intent, the right intention or attitude. So the intention, attitude of compassion and kindness and letting go. And that's, you know, that's what we're called on as we walk this path, to have a lot of compassion. And of course, you're not always going to have it. You're not expected to always be compassionate. Of course, all kinds of anger and all kinds of other things will come up and occur. But you're not told to be compassionate. You're told to have the intent to be compassionate. Which means that when you feel angry or cruel or critical or something, you're not bad for that. You want to be compassionate towards that. Harmlessness. You know, you don't want to be harmless towards yourself. You don't beat yourself up for that. But to be intent on compassion means to not be committed to the anger, not be committed to the cruelty, the criticalness, the judgmentalism. It might still happen. There's a world of difference between being committed to it and justifying it versus having it and not really standing behind it. Yes, it's happening. This is what happens to human beings, and I'm not going to put salt in the wound by being angry at myself for being angry. It's okay. Let's see, the intent is to be compassionate, which means partly just to kind of believe or value or cherish that compassion has a role, even if we can't muster it up. The big difference is to appreciate it. Yes, it would be good. So we have the view, and then we have the intention for walking the path, and then we begin walking. There's no path without walking. And that can be understood to be to endeavor, to make effort, right effort. Samma vayama in Pali. And this whole thing of effort, earlier in the day when I was thought about giving this talk, rather than evoking harmlessness at the beginning, I wanted to evoke something else. I'll do it anyway. My wish in giving this talk on effort was to evoke a sense of wonderment. I don't know how to do that, but I wanted to. A wonderment, amazement. A wonderment at this human life, wonderment at the path, practice, wonderment at what we have here. A sense of awe, wonder. It's truly awesome, truly amazing that we should even exist, right? We're in the middle of our soap opera of our lives, and there are more neural connections in our brain than there are stars in the universe. And you know how many stars there are in the universe? There are a lot. I mean, you've seen. I mean, I can't even grok the number when they give all these zeros. It's just an amazing number. And then they tell us that there's more neural connections in our brain. You know, what's going on in there? No wonder I can't get a handle on it. All this stuff happening, and I don't even know it. I'm not in charge. It's kind of amazing. And then we think that we see things just the way it is. We have all these rods and cones in our eyes, these nerve endings that each of them pick up something, send a particular signal to our brain separately in parallel kind of nerves, just little pieces of data. And this, you know, this amazing brain, computer in our brain, takes its individual points of data and somehow figures out how to reconstruct it so that our brain makes an image so that I can see you. I thought it was just seeing. seeing is just seeing, right? It's like obvious. Like I just take it for granted. I see what's there, and nothing to it. I don't know how many millions and millions and millions of neurons and are involved in this little act of seeing. It's not so innocent. It's not so simple. So we sit here with a mind that does these amazing things, mind that thinks, mind that fantasizes, mind that wants, mind that gets angry, heart that feels. I just think it's a wondrous thing. And so this idea of effort is kind of wondrous, that we have the capacity to make effort, which basically means we have a capacity to do things. How did we arise from stardust to primordial slime, they say, to these beings that can walk independently on the earth and do things? Opposable thumbs. It's kind of an amazing thing. We can do things. So right effort is right doing. What we do, what we're engaged in, right endeavor. My first introduction to the idea of effort in Buddhism, Buddhist practice, should have brought wonderment to me, but I was too young and what to say, it's compassionate about myself, too young and innocent, something. I was introduced to Zen practice, and I went to a couple of talks at San Francisco Zen Center in the mid-1970s. I was about 20. And I was immediately taken to the Zen practice and was interested in pursuing Zen practice. And so after the Dharma talk, I went up to the abbot. And in all sincerity, I said, you know, I'm interested in Zen, but what kind of effort do you need to use to practice Zen meditation? That was my first question to a Buddhist teacher. What kind of effort do you make? And he looked at me and he said, who's making the effort? Which is a great answer for on some people. It was lost on me. You know, it's like, what? I didn't have a clue what he was talking about. Until many years later, I realized that was a good answer, but you're supposed to answer appropriately to the audience. So he didn't know who I was, so he missed me. So who's making the effort? And so what kind of effort to make? Who's making the effort? They're both good questions. What kind of effort? And I think that for me, the years and years of practice I've done could be understood, or I could write a biography, autobiography, of all the different ways that I've engaged with effort and all the things I've learned about effort along the way. And, you know, it's partly a trial and error, finding my way and making too much effort and then making too little effort and then making, you know, finding just the right effort, finally getting it, just the right effort that was just perfect. Really worked really well for about 2 seconds. And then, you know, I had to kind of find my way again. And then I practiced in Zen, where it had a big influence on me, and where they kind of said, don't practice with a goal, just sit. And so I kind of had that idea, you weren't supposed to make effort, was kind of in my mind. However, in Zen practice, you do a tremendous amount of effort, not making any effort. You sit up straight, you sit up, you do all these long sittings, you know, you get up early in the morning, and, you know, that takes a, you know, it's a young man's sport, Zen monastic life, with all the efforts needed. But, you know, somehow the idea, the rhetoric was kind of like, you don't supposed to make an effort to get anything, just to be. So I didn't like the idea of, I came to a funny place where I made a lot of effort and enjoyed making effort, but I didn't tell myself I was making effort. I pretended I wasn't, kind of. See, I was kind of confused, right? And so it went as far as when the first time I gave an 8-part series, when I started teaching Vipassana, 8-part series on the Eightfold Path, a whole series of talks on Monday evenings. I was, you know, dutifully went through them in sequence, and then I just conveniently jumped over effort. Skipped it because I just couldn't relate to it. And then later I kind of came to terms with it and understood that much more what it means, this term, right effort. And in fact, I had a great appreciation for effort. In fact, had made a lot of effort in my practice. But effort is also, the whole topic of effort is dangerous. That's why I wanted to evoke harmlessness at the beginning. You know, so many practitioners have burned themselves by the effort they made. I've gotten headaches from making too much effort, the wrong kind of effort, exhausted myself, all kinds of things. So finding our way with effort is very important. So that question, who's making effort, is a nice entry point to the topic, because when we make effort for anything at all, whatever we're doing, often we're bringing a lot of self with us. And it's interesting to go and look at the self that we're bringing with us, the self ideas, the conceit, the concepts of self and what we should be, who we should be, who we shouldn't be with us. And one of the functions of practicing on retreat like this is you make kind of consistent, regular effort over and over again in this kind of environment, and you start noticing that you have a lot of baggage with your effort. And then you begin, in a way you can't see sometimes in daily life. And so you start seeing, I have a lot of extra stuff is not needed. I don't need to have all these ideas and concepts with me. So, for example, when I first started meditating, meditation was great for me. I would meditate at home 45 minutes, and I felt good afterwards. It felt really nice. And I thought, oh, I can do this. I can get concentrated and settled. It feels really great. And I'm a good meditator. That's the first baggage. I'm a good meditator. So I'm going to go to retreat as a good meditator, and I'm going to meditate, and I'm going to have this really good time. I'll go even further. And what I didn't realize was that I led a pretty busy life, because I'm a stressful life, and all I had to do, I didn't have to meditate, all I had to do was to sit quiet, and I would relax. And so, but I was congratulating myself for being a good meditator. But I wasn't, you know, my relaxation had very little to do with my meditation, just that I was just, you know, I'd stopped. But I had this idea that I was a good meditator and I was doing it, and so I was going to go on retreat and I was going to do it even better, even more. So at the retreat, that initial kind of relaxation that I experienced at home stopped with it, you know, I got that benefit after one sitting. And then, you know, I was going to, okay, I'm doing it. I'm the one who's going to do it. I'm the good meditator. So I'm going to push ahead. And from then on, it was downhill. The more I tried to be the good meditator, the less my mind got calm, more agitated it got, the less concentrated I became. So I went to, of course, but what do you do then? You try harder. And then trying harder didn't work, so I tried harder again. And I was miserable. And by the third day of the retreat, I just reached rock bottom. It was like so ugly. And finally, I just said, I give up. I don't know how to do this. And when I gave up, that's when the retreat began. That's when I started settling in and really learning how to meditate. So I brought all this baggage with me in the doing, the ideas of myself and success and being the good meditator and all this. Another idea that I carried with me at a certain time in my practice was a very subtle little piece of baggage that I carried along. And that was, whatever was happening to me was not it. Didn't matter what it was. It was just a good general policy. the grass was always greener somewhere else. And so it was always kind of like looking somewhere else for it, whatever it was going to be. And I could never feel settled, content, or at peace with how things actually were, because it's an underlying idea that wherever I was experiencing was somehow wrong. So that was a kind of, that, you know, so whatever effort I made had that as part of it, the subtle attitude, the grass is greener elsewhere. And then I had this subtle attitude at some, for a while in my practice of being mindful, but the mindfulness was imbued with looking for something to happen. I was waiting for something to happen. Sometimes when I had struggles or pain, physical pain or emotional pain, I'd be like a cat at the mouse door, kind of, you know, being right there watching the pain or being present, but waiting to see it go away. I was expecting it to go away. And then that I only really saw that I did that when, over several retreats, I noticed that I'd come back from lunch or from walking period meditation or taking a break or something, and I come back to sit and meditate, and where's that pain? Where did it go? It you know, I didn't see it go. It just kind of somehow went away when I wasn't paying any attention. And so then I started noticing that I had this added effort, always looking for the key or looking for the time it was going to go poof, as if it was supposed to go poof. So that, and then I was able to back off from that extra effort, that extra idea. There's ideas of needing to prove yourself, to prove myself. I need to look good. You know, or I need to get someone's approval. When I was sitting at the Zen Center once, they had a 7-day retreat. They had this custom of, I was a pretty new student, maybe it was my second retreat, and the custom back then was that the last sitting of the evening, they wouldn't ring the bell to end it until the abbot came in and would say a few words of inspiration or recite a poem or something. And sometimes he was busy doing interviews late into the evening. So we'd be sitting there, we couldn't move because they wouldn't ring the bell to end the sitting. We were always waiting for him to come, and, you know, minutes go on and on and on. And in Zen, you know, you can't move. And you have to sit in this kind of yogic way. And my legs were on fire. It was so painful. So painful. And I was just kind of burying it and burying it and burying it and burying it. Please come. I was doing more like please come meditation. Just for the abbot, you know, begging, you know. And finally, the effort was too much for me. And I collapsed. Just in the most un-Zen-like way. You know, just like, you're not supposed to do this in Zen, but you know, I just and I was sitting right in front of the door, and just then the door opened and the abbot walked in. I was mortified. And I went back to my room after that and cried. Poor Gil. It was part there of, you know, just. And so I was, you know, all this ideas of shoulds and how I looked in the eyes of other people and being a good meditator and then failing, you know. And so I was carried with me, not just the efforts, but also all these other ideas that I carried along with me. And so a really important part, or a helpful part of this practice, is to begin to tease apart the extra baggage, the ideas and judgments and ideas of self and what we're trying to prove and how we're trying to defend ourselves or justify ourselves or ideas we have of success and failure. Some people, you know, every time you want to do something, you want to do it successfully. But, you know, meditation doesn't work in the whole success-failure department. So, you know, you're basically always going to fail in meditation if you buy into the whole success and failure thing. It's because, you know, I don't know if you can be successful in meditation. I don't think it belongs to that category of life. And I think it's just better to put aside success and failure. The Because I think it just agitates the mind. So what are all the extra things? How much extra do you bring with you when you make effort? What are you trying to prove? What are you trying to do? Is a very important topic. What are you trying to do? Do you understand what you're trying to do? Not only are you trying to maybe, you say, I'm just following the instruction. Yes, but what's behind that and behind that? What else do you bring with you with it? Whose voices, whose, you know, values are you bringing with you that you might have inherited from your family or from school teachers or society or something? And I think one of the goals is to try to have simpler and simpler effort, or cleaner effort. Effort that doesn't, it's not complicated. Maybe a better word is uncomplicated effort. Effort that doesn't have the complication of all these extra baggage that we don't need. I love the expression, a simplicity of being. Just to be. To abide in the simplicity of being. As if we're complete, or as if we're as we are. So the right effort or right doing implies that we are doing something. And this whole dichotomy between doing and being is a very interesting one. And we know that it's fairly common for to be pointed out that a lot of people neurotically do, and an antidote to doing is being. So then we do our being, which, you know, sometimes works. Just be. But in that dichotomy, sometimes doing gets disrespected or kind of pushed away. There is doing. There is value in doing. And so, you know, if coming to, for example, if coming to sit in the hall, you come to just be, there was a lot of doing that you guys did to get here. You had to find out the schedule for IRC's retreats. You had to figure out what worked for you. You had to apply. You had to wait for the confirmation. You had to pack your bags. Some people had to fly here and unpack your bags and figure out what your job was. You know, it's a lot of effort, so you can finally just sit here and do nothing. So the idea of doing and making effort can go together with not doing, with just being. So one prepares the ground for the other. But also it's possible to, doing is an inherent part of human life. And if we want to reject doing, and then we don't have a life. How do we infuse, or how do we engage in doing, in effort, in such a way that it kind of expresses being, in such a way that it's just it comes out of who we are, as opposed to a doing which is to become something. So, you know, an example might be that if you go for a walk here in the little woods we have here, and in light, some part of times of the day the light is quite beautiful, and a doing that you might do is you might be in awe or appreciative of the light of the trees, of the nature, and just kind of like you feel kinds of lightness and delight. And that delight is a kind of a doing. Looking around and taking it in is a kind of a doing. But you're not doing it in order to become something. It just kind of expresses kind of who you are. But it's still a doing. So what is there something like that in meditation, where doing is not to become, but the doing is a little bit more just expressing who we are in a very simple way? And I think one of the things we are is that we are compassionate beings. I think that one way, even if you don't think of yourself as compassionate, we care about our well-being. We care about whether we suffer or not. And I think it's a very natural thing to want to try to do those things that alleviate harm, alleviate suffering. Those things that bring us well-being, happiness, joy, peace. And in order to do that, one of the prerequisites is to have the capacity to see the difference between suffering and the absence of it. See the difference between that which causes distress and sorrow and despair and sadness and that which causes happiness and joy. That capacity to see the difference is really crucial. And this capacity, our human capacity to differentiate, is key to the Buddha's path. And you see in the ancient teachings of the Buddha a constant movement to differentiate between two options that we have. And you saw that yesterday in Andrea's talk on right intention. Right intention is defined in opposition to wrong intention. So cruelty or compassion, ill will or loving kindness, sensual desire or letting go. Two different options. So part of the function of mindfulness practice is help us to see where that option is and to understand how to be wise about it, that option. What's the wise way to approach? So right effort, the right doing in this Eightfold Path scheme, is to do those things that diminish, that reduces the harm that we cause, and do those things that bring us benefit. The way, partly the way of the language of the ancient world is the Buddha is to do to avoid the things that are unskillful, and to do the things that are skillful. And if you are doing something that's unskillful, stop doing it. And if you're doing something that's skillful, keep doing it. It's such a basic human thing. I think it was Donald Rothberg who gave a talk many years ago on these are called the four right efforts. So I'll repeat those four. So if you're not doing anything unskillful, avoid doing it. Right? If you're minding your own business, don't pick it up. If you are doing something unskillful, figure out a way to stop doing it. If you're not doing something skillful, start doing it. If you're already doing it, keep it up. So someone came to him after the talk and said, I'm from Alaska, and I'm a river guide or a kayaker or something. And this is exactly what we are taught to do. avoid getting in trouble with your kayak in the river. If you're in trouble, get out of trouble. Develop your skills, and then keep them up. I thought it was lovely. If you're in trouble, get out of trouble. If you're not in trouble, don't get into trouble. And in daily life, it could be something like if you notice that you look at certain media, certain websites, and you feel worse afterwards than you were before, and it elicits kind of unhealthy thinking on your part, then you would avoid going onto those websites. If you're on those websites and you notice that it's not healthy, you'd get off. If you're in company of people, if you're in a certain company of people and talking a certain kind of way that you find drains you or makes you a worse person, there are people who are always complaining, gossiping, and it doesn't feel good. So, it actually drags me down to be around that kind of conversation. So perhaps sometimes it's the right thing to do is to not hang around those people because you know that the effect it's going to have on you. Or if you're in the middle of that, step away. Stop doing it. Or if you can't step away or avoid those people, cultivate the skill to not succumb to that kind of conversation. Cultivate the skill of having more constructive way of talking. And then do it. Keep it up. So I think in some ways this is very basic human life. It's not like complicated, bizarre spiritual teachings. I think it's what we do already. I think we all do this in some ways. If you're cooking, you probably do the four efforts already. If you're cooking food, you avoid doing those things which are going to ruin the meal. If you're making brownies, you don't put cayenne powder in it. Certain things you don't do. And if you reach for the cayenne powder by mistake, then you desist. Or in my case, if I'm baking something, I know that I shouldn't get distracted by something else while it's in the oven, because then I'll forget it's in the oven. So I avoid getting distracted, going off and doing my shopping while it's in the oven. So it's, and then do the things that's skillful. It's skillful, like when you're making bread, to knead the bread really well. It's skillful to let it rise a certain amount of time. It's skillful to have certain skills in cooking that you need to keep up. I used to be a good cook, but I don't cook so much anymore, so I've lost my skills because I didn't keep them up. So all this applies to meditation practice. It involves involves understanding the principle of harmlessness that's there in the background of what we're trying to do. We're trying to do something where you don't cause more harm. So how do you endeavor to cause no harm while you're here? What are the ways you do cause harm? What kind of self-talk do you talk to yourself that actually drains you, that actually makes you not good company, because you're going to get, you're critical or upset or discouraged or full of self-pity or full of conceit. There's all kinds of ways of thinking which kind of can cause harm to yourself, kind of. And then how do you relate to that when you see it? How do you relate to the things which are not so noble about yourself? I think it's a very important issue. How do you relate to that when you see something? Because some people end up in a loop, in a spiral of getting more and more bitter, more critical, and more afraid or something. How do you step back and offer this very simple acknowledgement, presence, just recognition, compassionate recognition, or unreactive recognition, just being with what is. And then as we start seeing and understanding ourselves better, we can start differentiating between what can I do here that supports me and what doesn't support me. So it took me quite a while on retreat to learn not to overeat. And I was a regular overeater. And I'd come back after lunch with regrets. And then I'd be angry with myself. I made progress when I would overeat, have regrets, and not be angry. The next step was to overeat and not have regrets. Just like, okay, I just have to deal with this. This is how it is. And then one day I stopped overeating. That's just, making an effort to live in a way that's more health appropriate for being on retreat. What do we do when the body's in pain? Sitting here, practicing. It's a delicate kind of thing to know what to do with pain. because to bear it and push through it, I'm going to sit here and just be, you know, become a, you know, a warrior. Chances are it's not very helpful. Or to feel, or to have attitudes that I'm a bad meditator because I can't sit on the floor, or feel regret about it. That's not helpful. So maybe it's helpful to relax and not sit with the pain and sit in a chair or do something else. Or someone might have a pain, and every first indication of a pain, they go and change their posture, or get up and leave, or get an aspirin, or go eat some more food, or something. And what's, what would be helpful is, to, within reason, to sit and be present for the pain, not always try to escape it, not always try to change it. So sometimes what's helpful is to avoid it, sometimes what's helpful is to face it. How do you know which is helpful? And this is where you have to trial and error, to kind of understand yourself. What is useful here? What effort is useful? Is it effort to stay present with the pain? Is it helpful to back off from it? In different days, you'll have different answers to that question. Different kinds of pains will have different kind of answers. It's really great to have a pain which you know is not going to cause you any damage. You know, really good one, it's not really a pain, really good one not to move to, is an itch. You know, no one, as far as I know, no one has died on retreat yet from an itch. And it isn't that we want you to be tortured, but rather to stay with the itch might help you understand a lot about yourself, might understand how you operate around fear, aversion, how beliefs come into play, how you get into all kinds of fantasies about what the itch might mean, and all kinds of things kind of get brought out to the forefront as you don't give in to the itch. And you get to see yourself, understand yourself really well. And then someday it's going to happen where you're going to be in a situation where you can't scratch, where there's some kind of difficulty you're in that you can't alleviate. And because you know yourself so well in this laboratory here, it translates to that challenging situation that you recognize the thoughts, you recognize the beliefs, you recognize the impulses, because you're so familiar with them, that you can stay free. And you learn that because you hung out there with the itch rather than scratching. Or you hung out there with the pain for a while to learn about yourself and understand yourself and learn how to have equanimity and peace with the pain. Or you're feeling really discouraged sitting and meditating. And rather than giving in to discouragement and giving up, you persisted. You just hung in there. If Nelson Mandela can do it for 27 years, I think I can do this sitting with my discouragement. I just sit and stay. And it might not be pretty, but you might learn a lot about yourself in that process. You might learn about how you tend to get hooked by discouragement, what you believe about it, what you think it says about yourself. You might learn about your aversion, your pushing away, your desire to run away. You might notice how you kind of go numb when you're under too much challenge. Or you might notice when you're in a lot of challenge like that, you want to blame and get angry. You feel discouraged and you want to find someone to blame. And someone, who's the director of the retreat center? You can write a letter about the tissue paper is the wrong color. If only it wasn't brown, all those paper towels, they were white, then you'd be happy. But maybe a silly example, but the idea of sort of learning about how we work, how do we work, what goes on in us? And so to persist with discouragement so we learn and find our way and not believe in it, not succumb to it, but to call upon our capacity for attention, our capacity for investigation, our capacity for nobility, our capacity not to succumb. And then there are cultivating skillful things, useful things. It's useful to cultivate compassion. It's useful to evoke it. It's useful to be reminded that it's a good idea. Even if you can't evoke it, it's just nice to have it hovering over your left shoulder, close by. It's a wondrous thing. It's a really wondrous thing that compassion, the compassionate response and impulse, causes your body to secrete oxytocin. Isn't that amazing? And oxytocin makes you feel good. You feel bad because someone's suffering, and you kind of have this kind of feeling of heart-open compassion, and you get rewarded. Isn't that an amazing universe? I think it's pretty amazing. How do we get, you know? So there are some things which are skillful. Compassion is skillful. Cultivating relaxation is skillful up to a point. Falling asleep is not so useful. Being complacent is not skillful. But some relaxation is really good. It's skillful to have some joy, to enjoy yourself, appreciation. Not to be Pollyannish about it, not to pretend or make too big of a point of it, but maybe there's simple ways of enjoying yourself. We had a discussion today earlier about some of us had used to have our interviews in the retreats with Sharon Salzberg. And when I saw her for my interviews, she ended each interview as we, you know, her way of, you know, saying goodbye. She would say, "Enjoy." And probably the first, it was a 3-month retreat, so probably saw her many times. I don't know how many, first dozen times I saw her, or I don't know how many it was, many times I saw her, I didn't register. You know, it's like, bye, you know, have a good day, you know. I felt it was just like a formulaic thing to say. But she said it every time. And after a while, I think she means it. I think she's trying to say something here. And I started to appreciate, enjoy. Enjoy. Enjoy the wonderment, enjoy the blessings, enjoy the good luck, the good fortune that you have. Enjoy, you know, it's pretty amazing to be in a place like this. It's skillful to cultivate mindfulness. It's skillful to take refuge in your ability to pay attention to what's happening, as opposed to take refuge in your criticalness, or your discouragement, or your judgments. Just keep paying attention. Come back to just notice this. Notice. Just notice. Come back to this. And it's so significant, the act of noticing, of mindfulness, that I really want to kind of convey to you how the idea of taking refuge in it. Find your safety in it. Keep coming back to just that. Simple act of noticing, no matter what's happening. Take that backward step away and say, oh, look at this. This is what's happening. And then do it again. And then do it again. And then do it again. So you're stepping back and not kind of being pulled into pulled into some of the less helpful ways of being that might be coming up. See it, step away, notice it. It's skillful to be calm. It's skillful to be composed. My favorite word for the word samadhi, or concentration. It's skillful to compose yourself in the middle of what's going on. And my image from this last week of someone who was composed is Nelson Mandela. he had this kind of bearing that he just was there in a composed and dignified way anywhere he went. They say that he was raised in his tribe. They grew up in his, as royalty. So he had a kind of regal bearing. But what it meant was that no matter where he went, he felt complete. He felt dignified. He felt like, you know, he wasn't pulled down by the difficulties around him, including in prison. So, he was always composed. So samadhi, or concentration practice, not being this laser-like focus from the brain down, but rather a holistic, embodied way of composing yourself on what you're focusing on. So if you're sitting meditating with your breath, you don't watch the breath from the control tower, but you settle around the experience of breathing. You compose yourself. The word compose, you know, I think when you say it in English, compose yourself, it's something you do with your body. Kind of like, what does it do? What does it take to kind of feel like your whole body is settled around the experience of breathing? Or if you're paying attention to something else, somehow, what does it mean to be composed as you attend to it? To be settled as you do. It's skillful to have samadhi. It's skillful to be composed. So there's things to do in this practice. There's things to avoid, things to let go of if we can. There's things to do. We do mindfulness. We be mindful. We be mindfulness. We cultivate these different things. But while we do this, we're very careful to notice if the way we're doing this is useful or not useful. Because when you hear that you're supposed to do all these things, I listed all things you can do. So now the next sitting, you'll sit down, and what did Gil say? I'll make a plan. He probably said like half a dozen different things. It's 45 minutes, so divided by six. You know, and probably I'll do 5 minutes on each, and then I'll have some time left over. You know, I'll go through the routine, you know, and get really busy. Maybe I can multitask, maybe do two of them at once. And I've heard teachers, you know, give instructions, do something, and I have, you know, just kind of tried too hard to do it. So you have to understand how you make effort, and what do you pick up, and when is it useful, and how to do it in a way that's inspiring and helps settle you more, helps bring you more peace, more harmlessness. There's no hurry here. There's nothing you have to prove. I think it's best to think there's nothing really you have to attain. These are all ways, the doing, all kinds of ways of doing that bring you back here. Bring you back to really be here. As soon as you think you have to get someplace, you probably start bringing too much baggage with you in your doing. But if the way you're doing things is to help you settle back more fully here, then probably your doings are helpful. So how is it that relaxing can settle you back and be more fully here? How is it that mindfulness can help you to be more here with what's going on? I practice mindfulness sometimes with a goal. If I'm mindful, then something will happen, which takes me away from my experience. But instead of to practice mindfulness, I'm going to be mindful so I can really be here with what is. How do we practice investigation so we investigate into our experience more fully as opposed to investigate again to get something? I've investigated, tried to blow my difficulties to smithereens. I'm going to get that. Or I've tried to get concentrated. I've had the kamikaze kind of concentration kind of, I'm going to, you know, torpedo it. If I just really zero in, my difficulties will blast away. that doesn't stay with, keep me with my experience. How do I get composed so I'm really here with my experience? How do rather than kind of that Gil says to enjoy, you know, I better go out and, you know, start skipping or something. Rather, in what way can I touch into joy so that I'm more here, more willing to really be here, embodied, present for this experience? Because the more we can be here, I hope the more you appreciate the wonderment of this life. The wonder. It's an amazing thing to be alive. It's an amazing thing to be breathing. It's amazing to have a mind that can think. It's amazing. It's all amazing. No matter what you think, what your thoughts are, you can have the worst thought a human's ever had. It's kind of amazing the universe should produce these kinds of thoughts. 5 billion years of evolution, it came to this thought. The pinnacle for this moment of evolution, I had this thought. It's awesome. So to come here and appreciate, just be. Just here and just be. So make the effort. Do those things. Let's go of the things that take you away from your full lived experience here. And do those things that help support you to be here in your full lived experience now. And then I'll end with one of my first Zen teachers. He was driving me across the Golden Gate, the Bay Bridge in his 1966 Volkswagen Bug. And he was asking me about my life, and I was telling him the things I was doing, where I was working and different things. And as I got to the end of it, he turned to me and he said, "Just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough." And that was a turning words for me. That made a huge difference in my life to hear those words. So when you can, maybe you can make the effort to settle back into just here, where life is just enough, as it is. As it is, regardless of what you're feeling and thinking and doing, it's possible to settle back and be here. So let's sit just for a moment, regather, settle in.